life, gotta make your own deals, chase your own thrills, pay your own bills. On the outer loop, sitting on chrome wheels, phone synced up to the newest chrome bills. On air, who cares if it's right or wrong? I just care which guests they invited on. Without a minute to stall, and there was liquor involved with some hype songs. And the night is young, right on cue, the talking begins. And we check out what Steve Bills got on the blends. A bit grimy, a backdrop from the late 80s to the mid 90s, till it finally takes us to a rhythm that works. And K-Chrome spits a verse that he didn't rehearse. Both flex skills, proving it's all in. So gather round for the newest installment, Chrome Bills.
Episode number 53 and a half.
53 and 7 quarters, which would be 54 and 2 fifths.
The cheers are well deserved tonight because it's a very, very special Chrome Bills.
Indeed.
Got a big interview. The homie C's Mikes was out on tour and was able to lock down an interview with the one and only Sage Francis.
Keep shit locked down.
So that will be coming up on today's episode of Chrome Bills. As always, I'm K Chromosome. Steve Bills in the house. C's Mikes. What's up, fellas?
Hello. I'll say it on mic this time.
He actually had his mic turned off for that. You're missing the point.
Are we going?
I was so unprepared for the show.
Yeah, yeah. So shout out. Yo, shout out to us. Subscribe. Subscribe. That's all I'm going to ask. A lot of people on podcasts will tell you to subscribe and rate and like send it to your grandmother. I just want you, whoever's listening, to subscribe to this shit so we can get our weight up. You know, we're not balling, shot calling. We're taking it back to the days of yes y'alling. So.
Well, here's the other thing. You got a couple different ways to find us.
Sure.
You can find us on SoundCloud, Chrome Bills. You can download every episode from there. You could find us on iTunes. I guess the point that I'd like to make to each and every one of you is somehow you found us. You're listening to us right now.
True.
We can find you. Keep that in mind. So I strongly urge you to repost this.
Right.
And, you know, subscribe. Hey, listen, honestly, all three of us listen to a bunch of different podcasts. We like what we like. We subscribe. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's all we're asking from you. If you like what you hear, stick with us.
I actually realized that I like a lot of podcasts and I haven't subscribed to any of them.
You're a dick.
So I just, that's...
You're basically a dude that like was on to early Napster. Mm-hmm.
I was just thinking of that same thing. He's like the independent rapper in 2001 who's like, buy my shit, but also has 24 gigs of stuff off Napster. And it's just like, who is this AC Alone guy? He's great.
You talking about me?
Pasty Alone.
No, but anyone that likes AC Alone, Cole starts like, he puts his eye up and he's like, you talking about me?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of Pasty Alone, my alter ego... We have a running theme on every Chrome Bills.
Okay.
Sometimes more than others.
Do tell.
Yeah.
Do we ever.
We have a rap crew, and they're called Different Styles.
Yuff.
And each one has just a different crazy name and its own completely different style. Different stees, mm-hmm. different, you know, it's what makes them tick.
Right.
So last week we read 1 through 20, I believe.
Right.
Let's hit them with 21 through 30.
All right. 21, Jersey Semantics. I don't understand that one.
I don't get that either. But I feel like it was mine. I don't get it, but I think it was semantics. Mine.
Jersey Semantics. All right, number 22, OB Once.
How many? Just once.
Not to be confused with OB Trice, right?
He had a lot of names and a lot of gimmicks.
And he was like, right.
You know?
Right. Number 23, extra towels and DJ 3 shirts.
Is that one dude?
I think he is one dude, actually.
Wow. Yeah, they're like, how many people in your crew? Is it just me?
And he's sitting across from me right now.
Why do you have an E?
This guy plays basketball and he brings 4 shirts to basketball.
What, man, you're selling me out.
Oh, well, thank God. Have you ever checked him? Like, if you're guarding him in the post and he hasn't changed a shirt in 4.5 minutes, you're just like, oh, dude, that's insane.
What if I made it to the NBA just because I sweat so much? Like, by the fourth quarter, everybody's like, yo, I'm not going near that dude. He's like, Palsy with another open three.
Yo, I've got another
guy like that.
I've got another Different Styles member you can add as 99. And this one is in honor of Cole while playing basketball. It's Vertical Slip and Slide.
Yeah, because I'm not going way up, but I will go way down.
Oh, that's pause worthy. Hit that button. All right, number 24, Double or Nothing.
Okay.
It's a duo.
That's a duo. Mm-hmm. Which they either rhyme, both of them rhyme at the same time, or they don't rhyme at all.
But it's not a sign of solidarity.
No.
They just show up everywhere and argue. It's like, no, it's my fucking turn today. All right, we'll do it together. Or one of them's in a pissy mood. He's like, nah, fuck it. If I can't do it, I'm out. And then they both leave.
Which leads to their producer accidental instrumental.
How'd you make that? I don't remember. I was really faded last night. Why, is it good?
Accidental, instrumental.
Number 26, DJ Dusty Benches, of course.
Yes. I'm sitting on him right now.
He's the illest. Slightly gay. MC Slightly Gay.
Now, we broke this down, and I want to tell this story again to you guys. I told it to you off air.
Right.
When I was working at the bar, there was a dude, and I wouldn't say he was the most politically correct guy I'd ever been around. Mm-hmm. And when there was a lot of gay people in that area, so when gay dudes would come to the bar, he'd be like, here come the silky boys. Now, I feel like that's a level like a couple notches higher than slightly gay.
Silky boys.
Yeah.
I feel like that's... Silky boys is a nice way to say it.
Right. But I feel like slightly gay is like your man's kind... You know what I mean? Like, I'm not tripping, but right. Like, does he know?
Right.
That kind of shit.
Right. You know? You know what? This next one's pretty money.
MC I like
Pretty
that
Money.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to skip to 31 real quick. Little Christmas Sweater.
It's your boy, Little Christmas. Yeah. That's a L-I-L, right?
I think it's L-I-L, yeah. Little Christmas Sweater.
Yeah. But he's like a 9-year-old kid. And the only time he ever puts records out is Christmas time. Like, my man's a one-hit wonder. Nah, just wait till next year.
There's artists out there who do just that. They just put out, they try to get that hit, you know, that Christmas hit.
Right.
So
they're called Christian rappers.
Just shots fired.
That was terrible.
Shots fired.
That was a dick thing to say.
So, yo, you guys, thanks for getting that interview, though.
Thank you.
And thank you, Sage Francis, for hooking us up, man.
You know, I did want to say Chuck and I have known each other for a long time, and one of the first experiences we had, particularly when it came to checking out rap music, was going to see Sage in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And just, I was a big fan of his music, and I remember Chuck and I would trade stuff with each other. You should check this out. And I thought Sage was somebody that we both kind of came to on our own paths. And that just shows you the inroads that he had made into that market that long ago.
Right.
You know, so he's still touring the world. Album's doing really well, and it was really cool of him to take some time to talk to us. I've done a couple shows with him.
Good questions, though. You even stumped him on one question, right?
I think I asked him, I think I gave him like two polar opposite choices. And okay. He's like, I'll choose the middle. There might have been one. He's like, that was a tough question. And as I told him, and I'll tell you guys, right. I asked the hard-hitting questions.
Yes, you do. I think going back to finding out about early Sage, it just popped in my head when you were saying that. Sick of Waiting Tables, right? It was like a mixtape, but it was on CD, which honestly was probably one of the first times I got like a mixtape album that was on CD and not tape, because this is the late 90s or early 2000. I need to pull that one out of the crates. Had all sorts of features, all sorts of like radio freestyles, but was very, very well executed. So I'm going to check that out.
Dope. And you were saying that you got the Hope vinyl, the nonprofit's album Hope,
yeah,
on that tour as well.
Yep. So I think when Cole might be blending two shows, because I remember seeing him both times at the Auto Bar in Baltimore. One was with Edan, a friend of the show. Edan was opening. And then another one was Just Sage, or it might have had like Grand Buffet or someone like that opening. And but it was also it was the nonprofit's album tour. And I copped that album on wax. It's one of the nicest covers. I love the record. Nice. But the cover work is amazing as well.
Right. Have you guys heard of producer Just Sage before?
No.
No.
Is that like a dude in different styles?
Just Sage?
What do you want on this pizza? Sorry. Just Sage.
Just Sage.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing I think is worth pointing out too, like, so B. Dolan was on our show the last two episodes.
Right.
Did a two-part interview with him. And he's part of Strange Famous Records, which is the label that Sage started, owns and operates. And he's killing it with that. His new album, Copper Gone, is available in these streets right now. It's available on iTunes.
I'm regretting not buying the cassette while I was there. He was selling cassettes of it.
That's dope.
I bought a drink.
Are they sold out?
I bought a drink.
Oh, you mean at the show?
At the show.
You can buy it online, strangefamousrecords.com.
Okay.
I mean, you said that you don't buy, what was it you were saying you don't buy? Is it music?
Cigarettes. I definitely don't buy cigarettes.
Apps.
I'll smoke them from Chuck.
Yeah.
Oh, apps. I don't fuck with that.
Apps, yeah.
This is, I actually bought this app right here. Do you want to give some free advertising to these guys?
Not particularly.
All right.
Sage Francis, here's the interview. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Be sure to keep hanging out with us if you like it.
Let's give a shout out to Sage Francis and his ability to reference old rap lyrics in his songs, because I feel like he's the best, one of the best to do that.
Very good.
I'll never say the best because there's always, you know, there's room for arguments with everything, but one of the best.
One on the Nonprofits album where I think there was a theme throughout that album of referencing a rap lyric and changing like one syllable to give it a different meaning. Right. And I still remember it was a throwback to a Nas record or a Nas lyric. He says, because when they start the revolution, all you'll probably do is steal.
Oh,
Bobby, the masters are back. Well, here's another thing. He has a song on, I think it's on the Nonprofits album. I know it was on the single, All Word, No Play.
Yeah. What's the reference?
Well, it's not specifically to like rap lyrics, but it's just like common phrases. And he'll flip them, you know, like make like a new like four word sentence out of what was previously two just separate thoughts.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Some ill shit. I mean, I'm having a hard time explaining it. That's how dope it is.
A lot of rappers used to say they were in drama school.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Wasn't that one of his references? Was like a reference to a KRS lyric? A lot of rappers like to use the word dramatical.
A lot of rappers like to use the word dramatical. That's true.
And Sage was like, a lot of rappers used to like to say they went to drama school.
Yeah. We also had the one where he's like, hey, Fife, gravity don't float.
Oh, that was...
yeah. Beam me up, wipe me down, clean me up. We're,
you said
we're,
beam me up.
We're I getting, did say beam me up. Because it's called Spaceman. Like, it's an outer space.
We're getting off track.
We're off track.
All right, so it's Chrome high, Bills, episode 53. Before we go into this, remember that the deal still stands. If you repost an episode of Chrome Bills on any form of social media, reach out to one of us via that same form of social media and let us know. You get episode 45B, the exclusive, what is it, about a 45-minute long freestyle session that is just murderous after one of the episodes, presumably 45.
Straight up, if you enjoy listening to the podcast, that episode is just 45 minutes freestyling that, all inside jokes, right. Lots of references, throwing back, cutting up. It's a good time.
I feel like people like the freestyle better than any other parts of this show.
We should freestyle right now.
All right. You have to set it off. This is kind of slow, though. Let's see what else we got here.
Yeah.
Oh, that's even slower. Oh, these are all slow. All
right. Something slow. This is the best you can make it. I look fresh naked. I'm about to awaken. Open the Kraken. You know I'm not a running back in. Used to play quarterback. Then I never got sacked when I was too fleet of foot. I need to put another rapper in his place and put a microphone in his face so we can have to embrace and give chase. I got the styles you can play, show. You're nothing but a waste, bro. You got no taste, sir.
Hey, what's up, dude? It's Cole.
What up, Cole?
How are you, handsome pants?
I'm just pretty as ever.
I can only imagine.
How are you doing with your beard care?
It's going well. I trimmed it up the other day, and someone was like, you shave every day. I was like, I don't have time for that. Who has time for that?
Well, you make it look like you take care of it every day. You're a good parent.
Well, thank you. So, ladies and gentlemen, the Chrome Billionaires out there, we got a gentleman on the line who needs no introduction, but I did want to say perhaps the most successful independent rap artist of all time. Sage Francis has built a career battling MCs, inner and outer demons, and he has a propensity towards giving so much of his heart that he loses his voice. Ladies and gentlemen, Sage Francis of Strange Famous Records. How are you, Sage?
Thank you. Yeah, yeah. All right. I'm good, man. I got my voice back. I'm ready to talk.
Let's talk.
Let's talk, man. How's everything been going since, when's the last time I saw you? Was it in, Atlanta? No, it was in, North Carolina.
I saw you in, I'm glad I made such an impression on you. The last time I saw you was actually the day after North Carolina in D.C. I got to do four shows with you. Yeah.
No, you made an impression. I just said it's all one big block of a blur right now.
But, well, speaking of which, I wanted to ask you, I know you had just done, you completed a full cross-country tour for the Copper Gone album.
Yeah, we did. It was, I think it was about 6 weeks on the road, 30 shows, and we, and five people in the van, and, you know, B. Dolan was on every show, and then there was there were several different openers from city to city, yourself included, and Cast One and Prolific and Sleep, and there's quite a long list. But it was one of my most favorite tours, definitely my favorite tour in the last day of my career, I'd say.
Why do you say that?
Well, just because it was, there was no disaster, there was no tragedy. Everyone stayed friends by the end of the tour, and it was, I mean, after taking 4 years off and you hit the road again, there's always the chance that you lose a significant portion of crowd goers, because one of the big parts of touring is that you have to hit up these cities repeatedly and grow the crowds and keep yourself on their mind, and that was kind of everybody's fear. Even the booking agent was reluctant to book the tour because he was like, man, it's been a while since you've been on the road, so you know, we'll see what we can do. But
to a certain extent, with some of the venues before you got there, particularly let's say on the West Coast, you were kind of flying blind in terms of your expectations.
What's crazy is more on the East Coast. The West Coast is almost always supportive. The West Coast has always been one of my strongest territories. And I even though I don't tour a lot, I play the West Coast often. So I know that the fan base is strong there. In fact, in a lot of parts of the Midwest, straight through the Northwest and the West Coast, that's where I don't ever have any fears about a crowd coming out in full force. But then when we start to hit, obviously there's a lot of the smaller markets that I'll never know what to expect. And I would have even put Phoenix into that category, even though that was one of the few shows that sold out before the actual show started. So that was great. But I hadn't played there in 4 years, and I don't often hear from people in Arizona. And it was just like, I feel like when a promoter knows how to do their job, which, and I don't mean to sound ungrateful, but a lot of them seem to not do that anymore. It's not like anyone really hits the streets that often, and they rely a lot on Facebook event pages and shit like that. You know, right. When I see a promoter who knows how to do their job like they used to when we first started out and hit the streets and like really actually putting in legwork to get or to make people aware that a show is happening that they might be interested in, you see good results. Otherwise, if they take the lazy route and they just be like, man, nah, everyone's just going to see about it on Facebook or on Twitter. It's like, yeah, my fans will who follow me there, but there's a lot of other people who they don't live online. I mean, I think it's a grand delusion of people who do stuff relying on the internet to be their main access to people. Not everybody can catch every update on Facebook. In fact, most miss it. And I know that firsthand.
Well, this brings up two interesting points. The first is that I think pretty early on in the tour, your new album, Copper Gone, which is available on iTunes and StrangeFamousRecords.com, it cracked the top five on iTunes in the U.S. and the U.K., and I think that was pretty early on in the tour. And the other thing I wanted to, after you address that, is one thing that's really amazing about your performance, regardless of the size of the crowd, regardless physically after the show, you make it a point to go out through the crowd and interact pretty much with anybody who's willing to stick around long enough to get, you know, a little bit of FaceTime. Did you talk to anybody at those shows and say, hey, how did you find out about this and learn something maybe you hadn't predicted going in?
I didn't ask that after the show. If I noticed something was awry, I would actually mention it on stage. There was a couple shows where I just straight up had to ask the crowd, like, how did you even find out about this? You know, was it strictly my Facebook updates or, you know, cause most places I never saw flyers anywhere. I only saw posters for about 3 or 4 shows and we did 30. So that was, wow. That was scary. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the major difference is I have collections of posters from all the previous tours that I've done, starting in 2000, 2001, 2002. And I have such a great collection of posters where they did original artwork. And, you know, it's just nice to have that stuff. And I didn't get to, I have literally at my house right now from the tour, I have one poster from, that was like an original poster that we didn't put together ourselves. So, but after the show, you're right. I mean, that's the time where I step into the crowd and I have interactions with people, but it's kind of the perfect time for me to finally like be in the midst of the people rather than, before a show. It's not a good idea to do that. So after the show, I go out there, but I don't get to hold any significant or, I don't know, in-depth conversations with people. It's a hug. It's a picture and an autograph and just a heartfelt thank you to everybody who stuck around and continues to come out and support.
I'll be perfectly honest. So I live in the D.C. area, and you were kind enough to allow me to open up for a couple of shows, including the one in D.C. And anybody that I told about it after I got the news about iTunes, you know, a lot of people had heard of you. And then I was like, and his album cracked top 5 on iTunes. That sort of sealed the deal because they wanted to see, you know, what all the fuss was about. Did you notice people talking to you about that while you were on the road?
Nah, just I think artists that I work with mentioned it. You and Sleep. I think you're the two people and the people I was touring with. Because it was a surprise. This was the first Stage Francis studio album that Strange Famous released. And, you know, I've been obviously running Strange Famous for over 10 years now, and I had never put out an official studio album, and I just wasn't sure if we had the type of outreach that would result in something like that. And also the fact that we push Strange Famous on people more than we would iTunes, because, you know, like, iTunes is cool and all, but it's the default where a lot of people go and they take 40% of the cut. And I'm not really trying to push that angle. So the fact much, and we did get good results from that, and we still cracked the top 5 on iTunes. I mean, it was a very good indication that people were coming out to support. Yeah.
The impact of being, maybe, you know, the money that you're getting from iTunes isn't as significant as you get to your label, but it does speak to the experience of being on the road. That you get into that kind of tour bus bubble, a tour van bubble. Wanted to know, how was the Copper Gone tour? What was the most stark difference you noticed between this tour, arguably your most successful one, and your very first U.S. tour? I don't mean like the second or the third one after your name had kind of gotten out there, but the very first one you did.
The very first one I headlined?
Yeah.
It's bigger, but there were also seemed to be similar risks and it was a gamble. I mean, I feel like I wasn't assured any significant profits, but there was a gamble from a lot of cities and for the people I was obligated to pay and be responsible for. And this time through, I just had more confidence that it would work out. I don't know, man. The first tour was just a total gamble, and it paid off, and I was very happy about it. But this one, I just wanted to make sure
you kind of knew you were holding 4 aces, whereas the first tour, you might have just had 1 pair, and you were trying to bluff people, maybe?
I don't know. That's a tough question. I have to remember. I remember just being scared that
I asked the hard-hitting questions, Sage. I want you to know that. I asked the hard-hitting questions.
I have to. You make me time travel because I have to go back 14 years, and now I'm like, I can't remember if that was – I can't remember how successful it was. I think it was more exciting just because it was my first time seeing a lot of these places, you know. And
okay.
The freshness of it wears off after a few years. Just the excitement of being in a new spot and playing in new clubs and meeting new people. And then that does kind of wear off quickly.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, if you hadn't toured in 4 years, I'd imagine before that you'd done quite a bit of stuff and maybe had some tour fatigue. How did that settle in at all on this tour? Or so how quickly? How'd you deal with it?
Man, the tour fatigue it didn't kick in until the last week, which was amazing.
Okay.
I mean, I took a lot of steps to make sure that I wasn't suffering early on. I kind of, you know, it's not my first rodeo, so I knew certain things to look out for. And then once I started losing my voice, with seven shows to go, that's when I knew it would be like, okay, now it gets tough. Now we have to figure out how we're going to make these shows as good as the rest and still not just be in total pain this entire time. But I still was happy by that point because I was like, there was tours where I was at that point halfway through. So I was like, okay, I've been here before. I know what I have to do. Let's do it.
Well, you mentioned also in terms of having some openers and also during your performance, B. Dolan and Lord Grunge were giving you an assist. I got to be honest, I was kind of disappointed I never saw Zalzan on any of the bills. What's up with him? Has he made his last appearance? Is that kind of over with?
Yeah, Zalzan had a song he was working on for my mixtape, and then I told him to chill. And okay. He's lost.
Did
he's
get
lost
physical?
Nah, he's... He kind of knows that he's not really welcome in a lot of places, but he's got some. I think he's gonna make one final stand before he's put down for good. There's at least two songs that he's been working on that I'm impressed by him, but they're offensive as all hell. So I'm like, if I'm willing to kill my career for you.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, I do follow him on Twitter. I hit him up a couple times, but he kept telling me to talk to you, so I didn't understand that. But
yeah. Oh, he's not technologically advanced enough to use Twitter. He does have imposters out there, though.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. So you mentioned, did you say that Copper Gone is the first Sage Francis album that didn't come out on like Epitaph or something?
Yes, the first studio album that we released, the first one we debuted, because I do, Strange Famous Records is in control of Personal Journals, but that first came out on Anticon.
Okay, so Steve Bills, and actually the last question was courtesy of K Chromosome, the homie on Chrome Bills. This next question comes from Steve Bills. As your approach for production and using sample-based beats changed since you have become a label owner?
I'm more cautious. I don't totally stay away from samples, but sometimes if I think the sample's too risky, I just put it on a mixtape. I won't really compromise an official album with something that's too sample heavy.
Okay.
But a lot of the music is made all the same way my process hasn't changed much. And a lot of the producers I work with are familiar with the whole, if it's a sample, who is it by and can we clear it? If not, then let's think of something else. So yeah, I mean, it's something we're increasingly more cautious about and there's no getting around it. I mean, you're either going to pay out of pocket up front or you're going to get sued down the line. And it's really frustrating as a creative person to like have to put creative projects to the side or kill them completely because you know that it's just going to cause you more trouble in the long run. But that's sad because like some really good songs get killed in the process.
Right. Well, it leads to an interesting anecdote because I remember I saw you last year at the Knitting Factory in Brooklyn. And I asked you before the show, do you have a set list or what do you do with that? And you said, you know, of all the things I haven't been blessed with, one of the things I have been blessed with is good recall. And I thought it was interesting. I saw an interview where you were saying that you just keep an archive of beats and you'll keep going back to something maybe that was from 4 or 5 years ago that has stayed in the back of your mind and then ended up on an album, you know, in present day. Is there anything on Copper Gone that sort of fits that mold of a beat that you had sitting around waiting for the right opportunity?
Yeah, a lot of the record actually, more so with the lyrics than the beats, but as far as beats, because a lot of the beats were from people I came in touch with through remix contests that we had at Strange Famous Records. So some of those are actually started off as remix beats that were revamped once I wrote original lyrics to them. But for example, like what you were just mentioning, the song Grace, which was the first official single with the video, a lot of those lyrics were through the ages, like some of them from 2003, some of them from 2005, some of them from 2006, and some brand new, but I mixed them all together and all with the This Is Not a Love Ballad, which was a reference to a Poor Righteous Teacher's song, the Shakila Redux, that it starts off with Wise Intelligent saying, "This is not a love ballad." And I always wanted to sample that. And actually, I asked him and he gave me permission. But then when it came around to finally doing the song, and this has been in the plans forever. I mean, as long as I knew that song, I always wanted to use that sample. I wanted to build a song around that sample. And I finally got to do it. And then I decided not to use the sample for whatever reason. It just, like, at that point when we had done the song, it felt like it was better to do it in an understated way rather than how he says it on his song. But it's like those little things are always part of my process when putting together music, putting together albums or even songs. And I'm trying, but as far as the beats are concerned, which ones might have been older? The Mate Wrecked that Curtis SP did, that's the very last song on the record. I've been holding on to that beat. I've been holding on to that beat probably since Human the Death Dance. So in like 2006, I've had that beat. I have a few beats from him that I've been waiting to use, and I just have to wait for the right situation. You know, I don't force a circle peg into a square hole. It's like, I have to wait for the right time, and there's a lot of stuff like that. I have to look at the playlist.
Another thing that's interesting to me, is you were always so good at freestyling, very successful in the freestyle battles. And I also feel like ultimately what you're hoping to do with freestyle is just excel in the moment. And I think the notion of being patient and waiting for the right time to use a beat, even if it's going to be a couple years, that's waiting for the right moment. I think it's another manifestation of freestyling. An interesting thing about Grace that you mentioned, actually, I think Alexander Brown, the guy who made that beat, I believe he's from Baltimore and is friends with Cubby Bear. How did you get linked up with Alexander Brown, and can all of our listeners start submitting beats to you?
Yes. In fact, I often put out open calls for beats, and I did so like a few times with this record where I just made announcements like, hey, if you got beats that you think I might be able to do something interesting with or stuff, something, to send them over to strangefamous@gmail.com. But I think that's how I came in touch with Alexander Brown, although like a lot of other producers, that probably also happened through one of the remix contests. Same thing with a guy named Cool Poindexter, this dude from Sweden who did he did Say Uncle, the beat. Actually, that was a remix for a Meter Maid song that I liked the beat too much, and I didn't include him in the remix contest. I just told him I would like to use it for an original song. I did the same thing with Over Under. That was a remix contest from 2008 that this dude, Le Parasite from France.
Right.
It was a really good remix, but I was like, man, this beat is like special. Like I want to do something better with this. So, you know, we revamped it through time, but he's been like, a lot of these people wait 5-6 years for me to do something, and then I'm sure a lot of them give up and they're like, oh, whatever, he's not going to do
right.
It's tough.
With that being the case, do you sort of have that conversation beforehand and say, look, you know, if I want this, if I want to use this, it's going to get used, but you might have to wait 50 years, or, you know, do you have that conversation with them, or do you say if something else comes up, go ahead and use it?
I do. I say both. I say, listen, because I know what it's like to create something and you want to get it out there. You know, you make something you're proud of. You want that gratification of other people, you know, giving you props for it. And
right. When
I make these people wait a long time, I know that that initial excitement fizzles out. And then, you know, I say, if you find something to use this on, you decide you're going to use it, just let me know so I can take it out of my files, because it's my files are just, I always go back to them and I always look for things that I can do something with. And yeah, I mean, sometimes it doesn't matter what you tell the people, time goes on and situations change, and some of these people, I go back and tell them I did something to the beat, and then they don't have the files anymore. Like, they never used the beat, but they just don't know how to access they can't get right. the stems for the beat. And that becomes a problem for me frequently. So, but working with people who stay up on their game and they can recreate things and work around new arrangements, that's another part of, I think, what I do well as far as me finding or working with people who know how to work with a situation. Not rather than just like, it's not just a one hit wonder type dude who found a perfect loop, but someone who
right.
knows how to build arrangements and yeah, work on the fly.
Well, speaking of getting something creative from people and getting permission to use it, I noticed that there's a lot more, you know, vocal scratches on this record. For instance, The Place You Feared Most has a scratch from B. Dolan, saying yeah. Space, The Place You Feared Most. Say Uncle has a cut from Lords of the Underground, Mr. Funky. Why, and correct me if I'm wrong, why on this studio album are there more sort of DJ cuts as opposed to prior albums?
I think this one doesn't really have more than other albums except for the Life album. And the Life album was all live instrumentation, which is why there wasn't any cuts on it. But I'm pretty sure if you go back to any of my other albums, you'll see just as much. I mean, I think there's only three songs on the Copper Gone album that has vocal cuts. The other one would be the prolific sample in
right.
Get
your ID ready.
Yeah, the ID thieves, and since those albums came out on Strange Famous Records, and I don't listen to too much other hip-hop, it's like those are the lyrics that float around in my head. So then I'm like, man, I want to use that for something. You know, like before I would be thinking of like a Nas lyric or, you know, there's obviously Rakim lyrics floating in the head. You're like, I want to use that. But nowadays it's kind of the homies I work with and me finding another purpose for just little like quick, short, vocal samples. So that's how that worked out. But Buddy Peace is obviously a very important part of that whole tying things together with proper cuts and making it sound, I don't know, he kind of elevates the song, even if it's just a 5 second piece, just something that he does that really solidifies it and gives it that like extra hip hop twist. It's, you know, he's magnificent at what he does. So more props to him. In fact, I had a song with Buddy Peace where he did the beat for this record, and it didn't make the record because he sampled something that we couldn't figure out. It wasn't even a clearance issue, but it was an actual sound within the beat that he sampled that was annoying, and we could not get it out of the beat. And we didn't notice it until later in the process. But then once we heard it, it just became a thing that I could not stop hearing, and we couldn't get rid of it. So we have to figure out what to do about that. It's one of those just obsessive compulsive problems.
Yeah. Well, speaking of people that were involved with the album, putting it all together, actually Steve was talking. He noticed that all the songs were mastered by Daddy Kev. And then throughout the record, you got stuff from, everything was mixed by Alias. I think he plays drums on some stuff. You've actually got somebody else from the Baltimore area, Athena Piatas, playing piano on Grace. You work with a lot of different people, and it's interesting because I've heard people say, why doesn't he have guest features? You know, and I'm thinking he does, but not in the sense of other MCs doing vocals. Do you sort of seek out those relationships with people? Do they come to you? What's the process for that?
Those certain relationships, such as the Daddy Kev thing, he had mastered. I've worked with him for a long time on different stuff, but I saw a video of him mastering an album and him talking about the mastering process, and it was interesting to me. I liked his reasoning for why he did certain things. So then we had him master Prolific's record, Working Man. And it sounded awesome. So this time through, I just was like, all right, well, I've used a lot of different mastering plants. I want to work with the homie now and see like how it turns out, which was, I mean, that was a risk in a certain way. Cause like sometimes it's best to just go with the people you've worked with, tried and true. You're like, you know what you're going to get. But with Daddy Kev, I think he did something a lot of my other albums might lack, which is he gave it this like specific punch. There's more beefiness to the songs that happens in the mastering process that people who are more familiar with rock would master the, I think the people who are more familiar with rock mastered the other records, and it kind of lacked that beefiness. I don't know how to explain it, but, or maybe it was just a coincidence. And it also helped that Alias mixed the whole record, which he never did with me before, but he did mix a prolific album. So those Strange Famous record connections where it allows me to see how people are working on other stuff. And then I get to apply that to my own project. I mean, that's a great perk of running a record label. If, you know, a lot of thankless stuff happens in this business, but that's one of the really good things before I get to put out my own album.
You get to tell motherfuckers what to do.
Yeah, and I get to see if something works or it doesn't for any other person.
Right. Like, you know, I did want to ask you.
If Daddy Kev, if Alias or Daddy Kev had been difficult to work with, or if they fucked up, or they weren't everything they were supposed to be cracked up to be, I wouldn't have worked with them. You know, and
right.
That's why I left. We left our distributor before we put out this record. That was another scary thing with Copper Gone, because like I didn't have a great a long lasting relationship with this new distributor, Red Eye, out of North Carolina. We had just started working with them within the year, and I was like, this is a risk. You know, I don't know if they're going to be able to handle this. And again, it became a wonderful surprise when we broke, you know, the Billboard Top 200 and iTunes, you know, whatever. And that was something I never experienced with my previous distributor. And I just was like, I was just so thankful that I had made this decision, even though it was a scary move. You're like, yeah, I mean, this is a fresh slate. We're doing new things and we're getting better results because of it. It's really, I mean, I'm very thankful for that.
Why did you go with a different distributor?
I felt like there was a staleness. I didn't have a good relationship we were working with Revolver, and I had never met any of those people. And even though I'd been working with them since 99, it was like we weren't seeing great results or hardly any at all. There was just little to no, relationship built between us over that long period of time. And I was like, man, I know that we can do better than we're doing right now. And
right.
I'm busting my ass on every level. I want an indication that the people we work with are also doing the same and that they're fucking going for blood. And there was just no indication that they were doing that. So like, all right, well, time for us to make a switch. It was a stale relationship. We were bed dead, you know, same thing with, I have other relationships in this business where I'm starting to feel the same way. I'm, you know, it's just scary to make that big switch. Cause I don't know. Sometimes it's like, if it ain't broken, don't fix it. But sometimes you don't know if it's broken until you try something else.
Right, right. Do you feel that way about our friendship? Are you worried about it?
No, I'm not worried about our friendship. I got to hang out with you a couple times, but not for very long, and that's the best way to do it.
True. Well played. Speaking of sort of backhanded compliments, I wanted to ask you about, from the moment I heard it, and actually I really enjoyed watching you perform this live, because for as dense as your wordplay is, never overly dense, but there's times where it takes me 10, 12, 15, 20, 100 listens to really get a grasp on not only the actual words you're using, the wordplay, but the concept. The thing that stood out to me with this, with ID Thieves, why do you think I let you get away with doing the radio-friendly versions of what I do? Like, I wouldn't charge you. Outperform, outwrite, and outrhyme you. Outsmart, outheart, and outgrind you. When I'd watch you perform that, there was a certain level of, I don't know if anger, but indefinite intensity and a visceral reaction. Is that designated towards anyone in particular, or is that just sort of firing shots all across the indie rap field?
I think it applies to several people. And I think depending on the era you ask me the question, it would be a different answer. And, I'd hate to give you one answer now and then that be the thing I have to stand by for the next 10 years. So, there are several people I think that those lyrics apply to. And when I perform them, it's a very cathartic, and I like being able to know what I mean and have my own specific target. But really, it's never just one person. It's a general feeling. Yeah,
I noticed a theme, not just in your music, but sort of your social activism along with B. Dolan, has been gay rights activists and gay rights. And I wondered, because I noticed B. Dolan had no shame in sort of just saying he's not a huge fan of Macklemore, but the message is cool. And I thought, I kind of wondered if these lyrics were directed in that angle or in sort of that direction.
Well, I think if they apply, the kind of thing is if the shoe fits, wear it. And right. If he thinks the shoe fits, he should wear it. And same thing. There's a lot of people who I think could hear that if they feel the sting, then it's about them. And if fans can apply that to someone without me telling them who it's about, it's more on them to, I feel like the burden should not be on me to say who it is about.
Right.
I feel like. Right. If it's clear who it's about, those people should have to answer for themselves.
If it don't apply, let it fly.
Right.
The
weird thing is I speak in such a general sense. It's like I'm not sniping anybody. There's, you know, like I'm speaking in such a general, broad sense, and everybody is able to pinpoint who they think it's about. And often they say it's the same person, so... For as far as I'm concerned, that person should answer for themselves, and I should never have to talk about them.
Is it Zoltan?
No.
Oh, shit. Let me ask you this. You and I have known each other for a long time. I've been super impressed by all the things that you've accomplished in your career. What are some things that, on a personal level, in the next 5-10 years, you'd like to have accomplished outside of music? Let me get into it. If you were a tree, what kind of tree would you be?
An oak tree.
Why an oak tree?
An OG.
There you go. So any particular life goals that you got? You want to get more cats? Have a dog maybe?
No, I want my house to be fixed up. I want this to be a livable home. My goals are very small, but yet they are to accomplish. So, I mean, that's what my focus is. That's outside of music. I really want, like, I want this house to be fixed up to the point where I can rent it and live somewhere else.
Okay. Where would you like to go?
But I've lived here for so long. I could live in Seattle. I could live in Holland. I could live in London. Anywhere. I just want to be able to fix this house up and have the freedom to be where I want and not have to worry about everything just falling to pieces while I'm away.
I tell you what, I got a beautiful condo for sale in Greenbelt, Maryland. I'll give it to you for $30. Come on down here, man. We'll hang out.
$30?
$30. Shit. I'll pay you to take it.
That's a deal.
Deal. Listen, I know that you've been off the road for a little bit over a week now, but you've got a lot of stuff coming up in the fall. You're going all the way to Europe, I think in a spaceship. You're going to be doing tour dates over there. Which cities are going to be the highlights for you? You want to give the fans out there the beginning and ending date and tell them where they can find out more info?
Yeah, well, it starts in Ireland and it ends in Croatia.
Wow.
And right now it's 35 shows. It might be more soon, but I think I'm very cool with capping it off at 35. We have everything listed at sagefrancis.net or at the Strange Famous website. The shows I'm most looking forward to, that's a tough call because I think like all of them will be a challenge in some way. So, like some places where English isn't the first language, I might have to switch up my set and think
like Ireland.
Or northern parts of England where they don't really speak English, but it's some strange dialect I've never really been able to get a grasp on. But they seem to understand me, so that's good.
That's good. As long as the money all transfers, it'll work.
London is always crazy. Like there's a lot of UK shows where the people wild out, like they just straight up mosh, and that's exciting. Like I look forward to excited and violent crowds if we can keep them off stage. And then France also gets kind of weird. Like, they don't understand me too well, but they love the idea of a fat American getting crazy on stage. So they kind of wild out sometimes.
Well, I noticed your crowd too, because you're not, unlike a lot of other, forget rappers, just, you know, musicians or performers in general, you're not a drinker, you're not a smoker, you don't do any drugs. And I noticed the crowds that you have, it wasn't that they were sort of tame, but they weren't always fueled by sort of the intoxicants that a lot of other maybe crowds would be. A Seize Mike show, for example, or a Seize Mike set. Do you ever have any interest in dabbling? And I only ask that because when I interviewed you when I was in college probably like 15 years ago, I think I asked the same question. Are you ever going to do crack or anything like that?
Do probably, yeah. Probably. I mean, there's time enough to do everything, I think. It's just you have to pace it out. You have to really, like, figure out your projected timeline in this life and when each thing would make sense to include in your repertoire. So, yeah. But that's a personal – I mean, that's a very personal question that I'll probably never lay out there for the public to criticize.
Correct. Well, one other thing I wanted to do, and we really appreciate, A, the time, and B, the amount of time you've given us. Before I let you go, I wanted to ask a mutual friend, Idea. You made it a point at every show to mention him. Just wanted to get your read on a couple of years after his passing, where you think, you know, the memories that you have with him, and if there's anything that you could share with our listeners.
Well, yeah. I mean, being on the road and having shared so many shows with Mikey, it felt important and it felt good actually to be able to shout him out every show. And I don't know, it was important to do that. So, I mean, I'm glad I had the opportunity, and it's definitely sad that he's no longer with us to share and all that. So I'd like to think people would do the same for me, you know, and he would. So, I don't know. My first major tour was with him, and we were we sat in the back seat and kind of just told random stories and bullshitted and fucking freestyled for however long we were on the road with Atmosphere. And, that's originally how I built such a strong bond with him. So, he's a funny dude, you know, like he was a weird, funny dude. And I think like we bonded on that. And he also, the other reason we got so tight early on is because neither of us was really interested in partaking in the so-called tour perks. Like we weren't looking to like sleep with a bunch of women. We weren't trying to get blasted every night. We just were, we talked about rap. We rapped. We were just nerds like that. And we wanted to rock crowds. We wanted to like pay, you know, I don't know, grow our careers. And it just was in the early stages of all that would come from that period. It was an important time for us. And we got to share that together. And to not be able to do so later on in life is definitely a, you know, a shitty thing. But I'm very privileged and honored that I got to share that with him early on. And I know he touched so many people. I mean, all the people who continue to carry his flag and wave it proudly. And that is just amazing, man. It's just crazy. I can't even put everything into perspective yet. I feel like maybe in 10, 20 years, I get to look back and like make sense of it more than I can now, but it still is fresh. It's still like, we're still trying to figure out like what the proper recourse is from here on out.
Right. Well, listen, we wanted to, everybody at Chrome Bills, Steve, Chuck, Cole, and then all of our listeners, I've been a huge fan of yours for a long time. It's been a pleasure to call you a friend. Really appreciate the opportunities you gave me opening up for you on the Coppergone Tour, and really appreciate you the time that you've given to us tonight on Chrome Bills, man. You want to tell everybody where they can find out more information about Siggy Siggy Say Trances?
Well, first, thank you. Thank you, guys. And I apologize. We couldn't do this in person, but I was ready to like fucking jump off a cliff at that point.
Yeah, no,
check me out on all the regular social networks. You can get me at Facebook and Twitter and all the bullshit. I try to stay active on them all, but Facebook and Twitter are pretty good. But really, the constant updates and relevant stuff will always be at strangefamousrecords.com. And thank you for being part of the shows and not get what?
You said you get more money from, well, before we get to you thanking me, you said that, and I want to make this point to our listeners, you get more money from the sales when people buy it directly from strangefamousrecords.com. Is that what I heard you say earlier?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the direct connection between us and fans. But if they have a gift card for Amazon or iTunes, go for it. You know, fuck it. But, yeah. And you who, you offered yourself for the whole tour and I told you to fucking fall back and I left you empty handed and you took a picture of that. But you were always gracious, always a very cool dude. And thank you so much for, being that cat.
Word up. Thank you, Sage.
All right, brother.
Be in touch, dog.
Peace.
Peace.
You. I wanted to ask him about Randy.